Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The upcoming 18th House District special election is in its home stretch, and the Democratic candidate says he's working hard to get his message out.
It's important to go out and vote that this has implications, that there's two distinct candidates in this race, and there's a choice to be made.
We talked to David Bentz about the race and the issues. STEM education has been getting a lot of attention, but arts advocates say add an A for STEAM.
When we look at it that way, quality arts education that is either integrated in with your STEM lessons or history lessons or any other lessons, it raises the value.
In our arts playlist, Delaware Center for the Contemporary Arts Executive Director John Shipman shares his thoughts on arts education. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at the state's smarter balanced student test results, examine how the University of Delaware is working to change how it handles sexual assault and misconduct on campus, and hear what researchers have learned from the state's only commercial-sized wind turbine. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. There's just over a week left before Newark area voters in the 18th representative district head to the polls to decide who will replace State Rep. Michael Barbieri. But as we told you last week, the September 12th special election to fill the seat Barbieri left to lead the State Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health has wider implications. Should Democrats lose the seat, they will no longer hold a supermajority in the House that allows them to pass tax or fee increases without any Republican support. And that would come just a year after Democrats lost their Senate supermajority when Republican Bryant Richardson unseated longtime Democratic State Senator Robert Venables in the Laurel area. So that makes this race between Democrat David Bentz, a legislative aide for Barbieri, and Eileen O'Shaughnessy Coleman, a Republican who's lived in the district for nearly 25 years, a critical one. And with that in mind, we sat down with both candidates recently to learn about them and where they stand on the issues. Last week, you'll recall we talked to Eileen O'Shaughnessy Coleman. This week, we hear from David Bentz.
What prompted you to run for the seat when it came open?
So it was really my passion for public service. It's something that I've been doing. I've been working with the legislature for a couple years now. The last two really being the point person for the 18th district in the General Assembly, the person that they get on the phone when they call and have issues that they want to talk about or make us aware of or need some sort of assistance navigating the bureaucracy, the maze of state services. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed helping people. And when this seat opened up, I just felt as though if I wanted to continue to be able to do that, that this was a good opportunity for me to step up and be the direct representative.
So I imagine that you feel like you have a tremendous familiarity with not only the constituents of this district, but also the issues that are really on their minds.
Absolutely. You know, it's something that I've had the chance to speak with them about, both in previous campaigns and then also, you know, working for their representative. You know, I understand what issues matter to them, you know, what they want us to be doing in Dover and what sort of services they depend on and what they would like us to focus on a little bit more than some other things. So I do feel like I've got a lot of experience. I feel like I'm going to be able to hit the ground running from day one. There'll be no learning curve. I'll just be able to get to work for the residents and give them the sort of service that they deserve from day one.
Let's talk about a couple of issues, and certainly one of the biggest ones this past year was the budget itself. Obviously, last year the General Assembly was dealing with a shortfall, filled it largely with one-time money. Another shortfall, perhaps between $130, $170 million is possible this coming year. What do you feel lawmakers should be doing to deal with this budget situation?
Whoever wins this race is certainly going to have a challenging first year. And when you think about it, this is really what we're running for. We're running for this 1 year because, well, we would have to run again in 16. So I think that this is going to be the all-encompassing challenge that we're going to face in Dover next year. And it's going to take everybody working together down there, Democrats, Republicans, the governor, the legislature. Everybody's going to have to work together because you can't close the sort of deficit you're talking about, $150 million, if it's around that range. You can't close it with only one method. You can't just cut your way out of it. You can't just tax everybody and to close that deficit. So we really need to have people down there who are willing to look at all the options and see what's going to be the most fair way to do this so that everybody is shouldering the burden, middle class, wealthy, that everybody is kind of chipping in and doing what they can to balance this budget in a way that is fair to all Delawareans.
Having been down there working for Representative Barbieri last year, do you feel like having some firsthand knowledge of what happened last year and what options were on the table last year gives you a little bit of a head start in dealing with the issue this coming year?
It does. And, you know, it's like you said, we kind of used one-time money. We kind of, I think, found the kind of the quickest way to get this done, unfortunately, and now the problem's even larger. So this year is really going to be the challenge where we can't do that. We have to figure out long-term solutions to our spending and our revenue problems. You know, our revenue is largely, I think, unreliable as far as making long-term projections are concerned when we're depending on things like casino revenue, S-cheat, and things like that that are very hard to predict long-term. And our spending could be looked at as well, and I know that there's going to be an effort to do that because, like you said, we're not going. Like I said, we're not going to be able to balance $150 million deficit with just new revenue. So we're going to have to start spending smarter as well.
This race is critical regarding the budget. If you are victorious, the Democrats would keep their supermajority in the House, which does allow Democrats to pass tax and fee bills without any GOP support, at least in the House. Does that add a little urgency to you as you're campaigning? Is it something that is on your mind as you're campaigning for this seat?
I'm not really thinking about that so much as I am as far as the campaign's concerned. I'm really focused on just talking to the voters, seeing what they're going to want from me, what they're going to want from their representative when they get in there, what issues matter to them. But what you're talking about with the supermajority already lost in the Senate, mm-hmm. I think it has a little bit less impact because we're going to need buy-in from both parties to get this done anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw this last year with the transportation funding bill. It didn't matter that the House could pass it without any Republican votes. When it got down to it, concessions had to be made and both parties had to compromise and give up something to get that budget deal done with that new transportation money. So we could keep a supermajority, and obviously I hope we do because that would mean that I was victorious in this election and I'm working hard to hopefully be the representative that the people of this district want. But it's really, regardless, we're going to have to find ways to work together down there mm-hmm. because there's already, the situation is already as such that both parties are going to have to buy into any budget solution we have.
One other major issue last year was education. Certainly for the constituents in this district, it's a serious one. Priority Schools Initiative was, you know, kind of ground zero here in the Christina School Districts. The district itself also struggling financially because of two failed referendums. Obviously, opt-out was a big issue, particularly in this district as well. What do you see as your responsibility as a legislator to address the issues of education? What do you feel are the priorities in education?
One of the top priorities with education is certainly how we're spending the money we're bringing in for education. It's like you said, this district has, the Christina School District, which is in the 18th, it has been really the focal point of that with the failed referendum and then the result being laying off of teachers. And that really only exacerbates the problem, doesn't make it better. So we need to do a better job of using our education money. Again, the referendum model is something that presents a lot of challenges. It is, again, it's another revenue structure that is largely unpredictable and is tough to rely on and account on when you're talking about long-term accounting. And we need to do a better job of spending our money on education and making sure it's getting into the classroom and not being spent at the top at Department of Education. I mean, I understand in a perfect world you'd want to have a phenomenal Department of Education and phenomenal schools, but we have limited resources and we need to prioritize where we're putting them in. I think that needs to be in the classroom. I think that needs to be supporting teachers so they can do the best job they can to educate our kids. My wife's a teacher, and so I kind of come from it from that because this is what I hear every night. My wife saying, you know, this is what we need. I could do my job better if we had XYZ, and it's just a matter of making sure they have the tools they need, because I think we have a well-trained workforce. Teachers are more than qualified to deliver top-quality education to our students. We need to get that money into the classroom so that they have what they need to then get our kids prepared to enter into a global economy and be competitive.
Is it fair to say that a lot of these other issues, things like opt-out and priority schools, are more symptoms of the larger funding issue, that if the funding issue was better addressed in terms of education, then maybe some of these other issues would not be percolating up?
Partly. I do think that the opt-out movement is coming from a frustration of over-testing. Mm-hmm. And again, what we do with this amount of testing that we're putting on the students is we're really boxing in teachers to say the goal is to get the kid prepped for this test as opposed to getting them prepped for a career or college or something like that, or just generally learning the subject matter, and the teachers are really boxed in. They're not able to kind of use ingenuity and different pull on their past experiences and so forth to really approach each kid individually and say, you know, what I'm going to do, this standard model that you're giving us to teach this test might work for 20 of my kids, but then I have 10 more that it's not going to work for. Mm-hmm. So how do I foster a curriculum that is going to make sure everybody's succeeding? And if I'm boxed in to just have to teach this test, it really limits, you know, what I can do and the creativity I can use to do my job to the best of my ability. And for the kids, it's really something that every day they're taking a test is a day they're not learning something new. So I have questions about that when it's so repetitive. And then we can't even be confident at this point that the information we're getting from the test is going to be useful information, and especially not going to be useful information when it comes out 6 months after the test was administered. So.
Are there some other issues that you consider priorities for yourself if you are elected?
Absolutely. I think one of the big problems in this district, because this is very specific to this district, it's really all northern Newcastle County, but this district sees it a lot, is how incapable our roads are of handling the amount of cars. Mm-hmm. You know, in this district, we have the Christiana Mall, we have the hospital, we have the Bank of America building, we're about to develop the Cavaliers Country Club site. All these cars, they're not just people who live here, but they're people who come here to shop and go out to eat, go to the mall and stuff like that, or come to work. Our roads are completely incapable of handling the amount of cars on the road. And it's one thing to be sitting in traffic. It's another thing where it's even spilled over into this, where now there's safety issues to be concerned about. And then DLDOT has a lot of plans to address some of these. This district has some of the most dangerous intersections in Newcastle County, where there's a lot of accidents, and DLDOT has plans to fix these. It's a matter of making sure that they get the funds and that we're prioritizing these sort of road projects. I think that that's important because, again, it's one thing to be sitting in traffic. That certainly lowers people's quality of life and is frustrating, but it's a whole other ballgame when we're talking about safety. So we really need to make sure that our roads are safe and efficient. And if we are able to do that, the area becomes more attractive to businesses who want to come in and know that they'll be able to operate effectively and get their employees in on time and get their products out on time and hopefully make the area more attractive to new businesses as well.
Special elections are kind of a unique animal. Short amount of time to organize, to campaign, tough to get people's attention and to get people to turn out. How have you been navigating this process and kind of tailoring what you're trying to do to the circumstances of a special election?
So it's a sprint, right? It's, you know, it's a 6-week election. It's very fast, and it's really just a matter of getting out there, hitting the pavement every night, knocking on doors, and making sure you're talking to as many people as you can and letting them know who you are, letting them know what this election is and what it's about and why we're having it, and, you know, hopefully convince them that it's important to go out and vote, that this has implications, that there's two distinct candidates in this race and there's a choice to be made. And I believe we're doing a good job of doing that. I have a strong volunteer base as well as myself, and we're out there every night. We're out there all day Saturday, and we're just really getting our message out there and letting people know who I am and what I'm all about.
And this is kind of a unique district, too. I mean, certainly the registration edge would go to the Democrats and yourself, but it is a district that has had a history of electing Republicans, specifically Terry Spence, for quite some time. Do you feel like this is a district which is more likely to look at the candidates individually and not necessarily just along party lines?
I honestly feel that every district's like that. I mean, if you look up and down the state, there's been not as many now, but for a long time there's been Democrats elected in Sussex County. Mm-hmm. And again, there's been Republicans elected all over Newcastle County. And I think that it's not just in Delaware, but the way Americans even approach the polling, but they vote for a person, not a party. And they go in and they want to hear what the person's about and what priorities they have and what issues they care about. And they want to vote for the person they feel is going to share their concerns and share their interests and go down and advocate for them in Dover. And I don't think that this district's any different.
Our thanks to David Bentz for his time this week. You can find this interview on the 18th House District special election and last week's interview with Republican Eileen O'Shaughnessy Coleman online at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, we'll take a look at the first batch of Smarter Balanced student test scores that came out earlier this week. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The long-awaited results from the state's first year using the Smarter Balanced Student Assessment are in. I spent some time this week looking at the numbers and talking to state officials about them and found rating how First State students fared and what their scores actually mean is somewhat open to interpretation. State officials said when they announced the move to Smarter Balance, they expected proficiency rates to plummet in the first year using the new test, and they did. Statewide proficiency in English fell just short of 52%, down from 72% last year in the final year under the old DCAS system. Math proficiency was just under 39%, 30 points below the 69% measured by DCAS a year ago. But Governor Jack Markell and Education Secretary Mark Murphy argue there's no comparison between DCAS, a bubble test, and the more rigorous Smarter Balanced, which requires written essays and math work to be shown. They choose instead to compare this year's scores to projections based on a 2014 field test of Smarter Balanced in 21 states, including Delaware. Using that yardstick, First State students exceeded expectations. In English, all 7 grades topped projected scores, and in math, 6 of 7 grades topped predicted scores. But when pressed if he was troubled by that 39% proficiency in math, which included only 23% of high school juniors making the grade, Markell responded,
"Yeah, I am. And I think particularly at a time when we know that we need people who are more and more skilled to do the jobs of the future."
But the governor says he stands by moving to Smarter Balanced and embracing these numbers.
The alternative is to, like, not do this and to not share the information. And, you know, a dose of honesty is very much in order here. And so, you know, we certainly want to catch this as early as possible. But it's important that our kids know and our families know where they are.
And where are they at the district level? Among K-12 districts, only Caesar Rodney, Cape Henlopen, and Appaquinimink exceeded 60% in English proficiency, while 2, Laurel and Woodbridge, were below 35%. In math, only Cape Henlopen topped 50% proficiency, while 5 districts, Christina, Capital, Laurel, Seaford, and Woodbridge, failed to crack 30%. And at the school level, there were schools with proficiency rates in the single digits. That group included the 3 priority schools in the Christina School District, Baird Middle School, as well as Stubbs and Bancroft Elementary Schools. But there were also schools with strong proficiency rates. Wilmington Charter, which tested only high school juniors, was over 96% proficient in English and math, while Newark Charter, which tested grades 3 through 8, hit 93% in English and 84% in math. Murphy says DOE will look at the districts and schools that are struggling most and how that can be changed.
There will certainly be an increase in regards to what how the state allocates resources. And that's really part of the value here is let's understand which districts and which schools have the greatest struggles. And let's make sure that we as a state are able to allocate resources to those students who need it most.
But Murphy adds the districts need to do their part as well.
I would also say that at the end of the day, we know and we expect and we hope that all of our district leaders, our educators, and our school leaders, especially in our most struggling districts, are taking a very hard look at this information and able to change the way that they teach, able to improve the services that they provide for their students.
Murphy adds that while this test takes longer to grade than a traditional bubble test, and there was some delay this year because it was year one, he expects to have results available earlier in the future. Though he notes districts got their results over a week ago and had them in hand as they prepped for the new school year. And despite the growing movement to allow parents to opt their kids out of the new test last spring, Murphy says the state reached the federally mandated 95% participation rate, with Christina the only K-12 district to come up short at 92%, joined by Newcastle and Polytech Votech districts. Murphy says discussion of what consequences districts that fail to reach 95% participation may face are ongoing and depend in part on what the state is told by the U.S. Department of Education. Murphy says Delaware ultimately wound up in the middle of the pack among states using Smarter Balanced, and trends seen were consistent from state to state. And now he says it's up to the state, its schools, and educators to put this new baseline to use to get its children on the right track.
If you think about it like a ladder, right? I want to know whether my sixth grader is on track for those sixth grade standards, and then seventh grade, and then eighth grade, and right on up. And so what we're doing is we're providing a snapshot, but a really solid snapshot for all of our parents, our educators, and our students themselves about whether they are on track towards college and career readiness.
Full test results will be presented to the State Board of Education later this month, and parents will get their children's individual test results in the mail in the next couple of weeks. We also talked to some district superintendents about these scores, and we're told they are looking seriously at the deficiencies the results show and how best to address them. We will learn, as we mentioned, more when the full results, including how various subgroups fared, are released at the September 17th State Board of Education meeting. The Green continues in a few moments with a look at how the University of Delaware is working to reform the ways it handles sexual assault and misconduct on campus. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. This year, the University of Delaware takes a big step forward in reforming the ways it handles sexual assault and misconduct on campus. The school is implementing a new model for reporting misconduct cases. It's adding extra training for staff, and it's refocusing on educating the campus community about rape culture and how to combat it. As students wrap up their first week back at school, Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek reports on the school's progress in changing its Title IX policies and how far it has left to go.
Sage Carson was a first-semester freshman at the University of Delaware when she realized something wasn't right. It was the first weekend of the school year at a party with some girls from her dorm. Sitting on a bench on the UD green late this summer break, she remembers.
One of my friends, this guy kept making out with her, and she looked really uncomfortable. And so I grabbed her, and she ran out and kept telling her, I was like, why didn't you just say no? And she's like, I can't say no.
Carson is a junior at UD now. She spent the last 2 years on campus leading the call for change in how the university deals with sexual assault in policy, practice, and attitude. That included rallies last year in response to a case in which a professor allegedly offered a student good grades in exchange for sexual favors.
And that kind of just stirred students' distrust in the administration and kind of brought out a bunch of stories of people that had experienced things.
That was in fall 2014, and it kicked off a year of major change at UD. At the center was their new Title IX coordinator, Sue Groff. She moved over from athletics and had a bit of a rocky start, says Carson. Anger from students, poorly attended meetings. But by this past spring, they both feel they've made a lot of progress. Here's Groff in her office in August.
I'm really excited about the first year. I was thrilled with the work that we accomplished. I mean, we have the new comprehensive policy in place that's, you know, going to be easier for people to find and navigate. We're going to be implementing an online module for all of our employees, full-time and part-time.
That half-hour module will standardize training for faculty and staff to be mandatory reporters, meaning they have to tell authorities if someone comes to them with allegations of sexual misconduct. And the new policy seeks to clarify and streamline the whole process. But those aren't the biggest changes in store this year. The headline is a new model for what happens when a student reports a case of potential sexual misconduct. In the past, those students went through a hearing process with a panel of peers, faculty, and staff. Sometimes they had to face their alleged perpetrator. Now, Groff says,
they won't have to go in front of other people. They will essentially work on one-on-one with the, our trained professionals for this area.
UD's two new investigators will interview people involved in the case, gather documentation, and write up their findings. Punishments will still be handed down through the old panel system. Groff says the investigator model was already in place for employees. Now it'll be a less intimidating option for students, too. UD declined to make the new investigators available for an interview, but their Fatima Stone, formerly a human resources investigator at the University of Notre Dame, and Michael Kelly, a Newcastle County and Middletown police veteran. Groff says she expects reports of sexual misconduct to increase on their watch. She couldn't speak for sanctions or expulsions, but Sage Carson is optimistic.
One of the biggest things is getting people to report, and it is scary. I don't blame anyone for not reporting. I don't know if I could do it. And so I think switching to the investigator model gets more people to report, which means we get more people off campus. And I think if you start seeing more persecutions for people that are doing these actions, then more people will report because they'll feel safe in the process.
But Carson says they'll still have a ways to go in educating students on what rape is and what to do if you think you've been a victim, plus how to help others stay safe. She and Groff both say that with some of the big policy changes out of the way, education is their top priority this year. In fact, Carson will be interning in Sue Groff's office. She's hoping to help the administration reach more students.
Many people don't even know what sexual misconduct is and what that means. So they don't believe if, you know, let's say they're intoxicated, they commit an assault. But we have affirmative consent at the school, meaning that if you do not gain consent from someone verbally, then it's an assault. And that takes a while to get through someone's head, that it's not a no means no, but in fact a yes means yes.
She also wants to work on bystander education. That mandatory reporter training for more staff is part of that. But they'll also be working directly with freshmen and everyone in between. That's with the help of Nancy Chase in the Office of Student Wellness and Health Promotion. She says not all freshmen have been exposed to bystander training before. This year, they're putting everyone through a popular higher ed program called Bringing in the Bystander. Chase explains.
A bystander intervention approach tries to engage every member of the community, every member of society in understanding sort of what their role is in understanding these issues, protecting people who might be vulnerable, and stopping crime from happening.
Chase has been working on issues of rape culture on UD's campus for more than 20 years. Like Carson, she feels those norms and conversations are starting to shift.
People who have been doing the work like we have been doing on campuses for a very long time are sort of sitting on this precipice of significant change, and a lot of what we've really strived hard for a very long time finally getting the attention and people actually listening and being motivated to want to see more happen.
Sue Groff feels UD has been ahead of the curve with its Title IX policy and its responses to federal investigations and calls for reform. Nancy Chase says it's more of a well-intentioned system that, like at many schools, for many years has failed.
And that is very dismaying and really, honestly, very tragic to the survivors who have had those systems fail them. But I do think that with the right intention and now with the right focus, that there is a chance for rapid change.
A big part of that will be gathering feedback on if new measures are having an impact, like the investigator model and the bystander training. What they learn could have broader implications, Chase says. Campuses are a microcosm, a place where societal issues come into focus.
It makes sense because we do still have young people who are forming their values and still really actively learning about the world and actively trying to figure out who they want to be in the world. But it really is still very difficult work.
Sage Carson wants to take advantage of that. She says UD still has some catching up to do, but that no school has a perfect situation yet. By the time she graduates, hopefully to pursue a master's in public policy and continue working on women's issues, she wants to have passed her activism on to the next generation of Blue Hens.
I think just having the younger students want to engage in these issues. There's a lot of talk of how my generation is very apathetic. And I've been seeing in our junior class that they're not apathetic, they're very engaged in the community. And so I hope that we can kind of push that on the other students, and hopefully they'll want to be engaged too, and keep these conversations going so that when my class leaves, it doesn't just stop. You have to continue to have these conversations.
That's exactly what she and others will seek to do this year. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Annie Ropeek in Newark.
Thanks, Annie. And stay with us. The Green continues with our arts playlist. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math has gotten a lot of attention in recent years. But arts advocates say don't forget adding an A to create the broader educational emphasis known as STEAM. STEAM proponents say their goal is to foster the true innovation that comes with combining the mind of a scientist with that of an artist or designer. The arts have long been recognized as part of a well-rounded education, but when it comes to budget priorities, school arts programs are often the first to be cut. Leaders at the Delaware Center for the Contemporary Arts say they want to fill that gap. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter talks about arts education with DCCA Executive Director John Shipman.
John Shipman, the DCCA is offering their first ever Educators Open House on Thursday, September 10th, and you say your goal is to start offering this at the beginning of every new season, which typically is in September, which nicely coincides with the beginning of the academic year. So is this a way for you folks to show the community what the DCCA has to offer in terms of other education initiatives?
Absolutely. I think that since coming back to the Delaware Center for Contemporary Arts in January, one of the things that's really been highlighted is two things, actually. We've continued to grow our education programs in the 15 years that we've been here in this building on the riverfront. They've grown into very strong, I think, and fantastic programs, but that I don't think that people know exactly what it is that we do sometimes. I think that the educators and the students and the parents that have been engaged in our programs throughout the years, they're very aware of what we do, and they can be advocates, But a lot of people don't really understand the strength of the education programs that we do. So when I was talking to Sarah Ware, our curator of education here, you know, what we could do, I think we came up with this wonderful idea of offering an annual educators open house. And what we're really wanting to do is invite all area educators throughout the state, throughout the region, that could be impacted by our programs to come down and join us on the evening of Thursday, September 10th, and not only get a tour of the facilities, but really get a good explanation and understanding of the programs that we run, the opportunities and the resources that we're going to make available to them through the lesson plans that we're developing, either centered around the arts themselves or specific exhibitions. And that's what's really nice about the things that we can offer, is that we have the 7 exhibition spaces here, so there's lots of ways we can specifically tailor lessons or tours or programs around very specific pieces of art. But with the expertise that we have in-house, we can also make very generalized, in a way, lesson plans around visual communication and creative expression.
Well, John, art has long been recognized as an important part of a well-rounded education, but when it comes to setting budget priorities, a lot of arts are being cut in the schools. So is this a good way for us to supplement teaching art, reaching out to our community resources like the DCCA?
Oh, absolutely, and it's how we view ourselves. One of the main components of our mission is to be the resource for the state for arts education. It's always been amusing to me, in a way, that to think that we will all acknowledge that creative education, education centered around the arts and all of their disciplines, are so incredibly important to the health of a child and as they're growing and developing. But it's always the first thing that we cut, and it never has made sense to me. But what is wonderful is when you have organizations like us, like the DCCA, we're the ones that can step in and fill that hole. And again, it's what we want to make sure that we want to try to do with this Educators Open House, is that people see the resources that we can provide. And what's wonderful, this is what I really like about what we do with our education programs. Our education programs are transportable. They can go downstate. The DCCA for 25 years has been running this program called Contemporary Connections, and it's where we place artists in the school paired with an educator, and they come up with an integrated lesson that has the arts and whatever subject they're paired with. So for 25 years, we've basically been doing this whole, you know, relatively new initiative of STEM to STEAM, where we may pair an artist with a science teacher, and they'll come up with a lesson plan that will work in the classroom, teaching the kids whatever the topic is for science, but with an arts bent to it. Same thing with math, same thing with engineering. What we also like, though, is that we've brought this philosophy. There's a little bit of a debate about this STEM to STEAM, and so STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. STEAM is basically, after they'd come up with this idea of STEM, a way of putting the A in there. So it's STEM to STEAM.
I understand, though, there's a bit of a tug of war between proponents of STEM and advocates of STEAM.
I think that some people see that as a little bit problematic when we're on the art side, because we feel like we've been kind of just shoehorned back in there to say, yeah, we're important. But what I think that it does is it doesn't really acknowledge what the true value of that arts education is. I think we like to think of it as STEM raised to the A power, STEM raised to the arts. And what I think that when we look at it that way is that a quality arts education that is either integrated in with your STEM lessons or history lessons or any other lessons, but when they're integrated in, it raises the value of what you're learning in those classes. You know, everything that we do, we're not looking to create new artists. You know, all of our arts education programs, we give the students the tools to create work. We give the kids the way to think creatively. But it's not, in our minds, the way of creating new young artists. It's about an art appreciation, of course. But what it's really about is teaching these kids to think and solve problems with creative tools. And once you do that, you raise anything they do up to a next level. So we're looking at it as this STEM raised to the arts, so that when they go into their science class, they're going to come to it with a set of design skills, creative skills, that will then elevate exponentially the value of what it is that they may be learning in their class. This is, I think, a new approach. I personally have no qualm with the STEM to STEAM. I think it's a great initiative, and it has enabled educators and elected officials and centers like us to reinvigorate the conversation around arts education. But I think that when we really look at it as this STEM race to the arts, that's when we start to also talk about the true value of what that arts education is. And then hopefully that'll enable all of us to continue to value an arts education for all of our students.
Is it fair to say then, John, that you would think that STEM to STEAM has inclusion in skills like visual spatial abilities, reflection, self-criticism, some of the things that aren't really in a standardized test today?
Absolutely. And that's the thing that I think that you see some of the concern about all the standardized testing. It doesn't quantify these types of skill sets for these students in a way that we can all acknowledge as important. And that's why we make sure that we do these types of programs, so that the students can make sure that they have these types of skills. You can learn math, but if you can learn math without any type of creative skills or self-analysis or creative way to take a look at what you're doing, you're going to be flat, and all you're ever going to be able to do is solve the problem that's given in front of you, but you'll never be able to foresee the problems that may be coming to you, and you may not ever be able to think creatively beyond the solutions that have already been given to you.
Our thanks to Delaware Center for the Contemporary Arts Executive Director John Shipman for joining us this week. The DCCA's Free Educators Open House is this Thursday, September 10th, and you can find details about it at thedcca.org. Stay with us. Enlighten Me is next, with a look at what researchers have learned in the 5 years since the University of Delaware installed a wind turbine in Lewis. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. 5 years ago, the University of Delaware and the Gamesa Corporation installed Delaware's first commercial-sized wind turbine in Lewis. Since then, the 256-foot turbine that many downstate Delawareans are familiar with has generated power for the university's Lewis campus. It's also been host to a number of research projects to measure public perception, impacts on wildlife, and the machinery's wear and tear due to its seaside location. While it's a single turbine, it's paving the way for future wind development in the Mid-Atlantic region. According to the Department of Energy, wind power now contributes 5% of the nation's energy. The federal government aims to produce 20% of its energy from wind in 15 years. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's science reporter Eli Chen speaks with Jeremy Firestone, director of UD's Center for Carbon-Free Integration, about what researchers have achieved with the turbine in its 5 years.
So, Dr. Firestone, the wind turbine at University of Delaware's Lewis campus turned 5 this summer. So when it was up and running, what goals did you have in mind with it? What did you hope to learn?
Well, we hope to establish, and I think we have established, a successful research platform. That was probably first and foremost, because we have a strong wind energy research program. And secondly, we wanted to bring clean energy to the University of Delaware's Lewis campus, and we're also pleased that we're able to provide the residents of Lewis with some clean wind energy as well.
And how much power did the wind turbine generate?
Since its inception, it has generated about 24,000 megawatt hours. It generates a little over 5,000 megawatt hours a year. Most of the power, about 80%, probably goes to power the Lewis campus, and then the remainder goes to city residents.
Right. I understand that the Lewis Board of Public Works is also a customer as well.
Yeah, so that's how we sell it to the city, and our arrangements with the city is, I think, quite rewarding to both sides. The city and the Lewis Board of Public Works worked with us so that we effectively virtually net meter 6 of our larger buildings, And then we sell the excess electricity to the city at its avoided cost. So it enters into contracts to buy power, and that power is primarily fossil fuel and nuclear, and we sell it wind power at what it would otherwise be paying to buy that sort of legacy power.
And since the turbine was built close to residential areas, tell me about the local community's reception to the turbine's construction.
Well, I went to a couple of neighborhood meetings when I went in front of the city council to get approval. No one spoke out against it. It seemed to be just another item on the city council's agenda. At the neighborhood meetings, there was a lot of interest. There was large crowds, but I wouldn't say they were concerned crowds. They were more interested in what was coming to their community. Questions really focused more on potential effects to wildlife than they did how it might affect them as residents.
And speaking of impacts on wildlife, tell me about the bat shield technology that was installed inside the turbine. How has that device helped reduce mortality among bat populations?
The bat shield is really a series of software that allows more precise control of the wind turbine. So it allows you to operate or to turn it off in the face of various wind and other sort of climatic and atmospheric conditions. So what we know about bats is that there's a migration season generally around us. It's July, August, and September, and that bats tend to fly in the couple hours after dusk, and they tend to fly more often at low wind speeds. So using the bat shield technology, we're able to instruct the wind turbine not to generate electricity, so basically not to spin, for those first few hours after dusk during the migration season if the wind speeds are low. And so the thought is you're not going to lose much power, but you can do good by the bats.
Right. And were there any other kinds of emerging technologies that were tested on the turbine?
Yes. The central one would have been the Indar generator. So when the turbine was first installed, it had a generator that could operate on one of two frequencies, either 50 or 60 hertz. In Europe, things operate on 50 hertz. In the U.S., they operate on 60 hertz. And we took out the existing generator and we put in a new generator that was designed to only operate on 60 hertz. Now, that sounds like it's, well, doesn't come with the same number of options, but it allows you to have fewer parts and to be cheaper if you can design something to only operate on a single frequency. So we were able to test that, and that 60 hertz only generator remains in the turbine today.
And what future goals do you have in terms of the turbine? Do you want it to generate more power, offset more carbon emissions? What do you hope in the next 5 years?
Well, we hope that we continue to operate at the high levels that we've been operating in the first 5 years, so that we would generate another 25,000 megawatt hours of electricity. We hope to continue to do some cutting-edge research at the turbine. We will as well use it as an education platform for our students. In addition to having students come as part of coursework, we also have trained some of our students to ascend the turbine. You have to get special training and OSHA approval. And they then assist us with research by putting various devices up on the turbine.
Wow, that must be exciting to get to climb the turbine.
one person's excitement is, you know, probably another person's glad they get to see that person climbing and not themselves.
And since there is an elevating national conversation about wind energy resources and offshore wind, how has having this coastal wind turbine helped inform offshore wind development?
Well, I would say in a number of respects. One, it is about the most coastally oriented wind turbine in the United States. And we're here in Delaware Bay, we're in a very important international flyway. So there's been a lot of interest by federal and state regulators and by birders about the effects of the wind turbine on avian populations. And so our research there has been helpful, and it sheds some light and I think gives a sense of optimism that we can install turbines offshore and not have substantial negative effects on bird populations. So I'd say that's one. Dr. Steve Dexter did some research related to corrosion in the marine environment. So we know that can cause difficulty when you put equipment out in the marine environment. So that work is transferable and useful for the marine environment. And then we've done some work on public perceptions. We don't yet have any offshore turbines for which we can ask people about. We do show them photo montages of what we anticipate these projects are going to look like. But, you know, here in Lewis, we have a living, breathing turbine, and so we've been able to do some work and to better understand how people think about wind turbines.
Our thanks to Jeremy Firestone, director of UD's Center for Carbon-Free Integration, for enlightening us this week. And we're out of time on The Green for this week. As always, these stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes as well. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.